Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Clinical Strategies to Improve Patient Outcome conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Sara Butterfield. Ms. Butterfield, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to today's presentation. We appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us for the teleconference presentation. This is all part of our series of educational offerings addressing clinical strategies and organizational culture change strategies targeting improvement in patient care management for the home health provider setting. And we have a change in our presentation topic area this morning than posted to the original calendar. The SAY Network partnership call that was originally scheduled for today has been postponed to the fall due to a scheduling conflict. But today's call will still be a shared learning session with your peers presenting some successful strategies for improvement. We're very pleased to have as our speakers this morning Kathy Cook, who is a cardiac clinical specialist, and Eva Colin, who's the director of social work from Lifetime Home Health and Hospice in Rochester, and also Jeannie Lysing, and Jeannie is the director of performance improvement and staff development from Macaulay Seton Home Care in Cheektowaga, New York. Those of you who registered for today's call should have received yesterday an email with a copy of the PowerPoint slides and the handouts that will be referenced during today's presentations. We also sent you a program evaluation form that we appreciate your time in filling that out for us. If for some reason you didn't register or you didn't receive a copy of the slides in the evaluation form, as usual, they are posted to our iPro website. You can go to www.ipro.org, visit the home health section, and in the upcoming events section, you'll see today's call posted, and you'll see a link for the presentation materials there. As a reminder, the conference call session is being taped. We're all going to be posting it to the past events section of the iPro website, and that'll make it available for your future review and review by any of your staff. As we mentioned, all of your lines are currently muted, and following the presentation, each presentation, we're going to open the lines up for you to ask questions, make comments, and have further discussion. We're very honored to have two of our New York State providers speaking on today's call. Our first presenters will be Kathy Cook, and as I said, Kathy is the cardiac clinical specialist, and Eva Colin is the director of social work. We also have Mark Broussard joining us from Lifetime Care, who's also in the social work department, and they're based out of Rochester. Kathy and her agency, along with their second agency, which is Univera, are what we call veterans in the initiative to reduce acute care hospitalization and improvement of patient outcomes. They were part of the acute care hospitalization pilot project that started way back in March of 2005. And they also were actively involved in what was called the REACH Collaborative, REACH standing for Reducing Acute Care Hospitalization. That began back in September 2005 and has continued on to present day. And their agencies have collaborated very closely with our HIPRO Home Health Project team throughout the current ACE scope of work and even prior. And they've been successful in reducing their acute care hospitalization rates and improving their patient outcomes. We've asked them to speak today to share their process and success with use of telephone scripting and involvement of social work staff for patient follow-up and referral. And we asked them to share the tools that they've developed to support this process. So with that, I'm going to turn this call over to Kathy.
Good morning. I just wanted to let you know today about one aspect of our REACH initiative to reduce our acute care hospitalization rate. And we started assessing our patients agency-wide, actually the third quarter of 2006. Prior to that, we had done this on a pilot team, and then we spread it out to the agency. We have a written hospitalization risk assessment form, and on that form we have instruction for the nurses for what to do with the patients that are high risk. For all patients, we instruct the nurse to instruct the patient on a medical emergency plan of care that has written information that we include in our opening pack, and also to verify, clarify, and reconcile their medications with the patient and the physician. And if they're not able to do that on the first visit, we instruct them to visit the patient the next day to complete that. But for the high-risk patients, which we have a number that we've decided would be the appropriate one for us to designate these patients as high risk, those patients are supposed to have increased patient contacts to at least 10 during the first 2 weeks of care. And so that would include front-loading visits, but also the contacts could be anything, any disciplines visits, phone calls, telemed, CNS consults, home health aid visits, any patient contact that assesses the patient's status or reinforces education. Then we also instruct them to consider telemed, especially for COPD and CHF patients and any other diagnosis that would be indicated. And we ask them to consult with a physician to notify the patient is high risk and to plan what will happen if the patient becomes symptomatic. So we want them to be proactive in planning for an emergency. We also want to make sure that their care plan interventions address the risk factors identified in the high-risk assessment, the ones that were identified as making the patient high risk. And we also ask them to consider recommendations for additional disciplines, and we have a key on our paper risk assessment that indicates additional disciplines such as rehab and social work and home health aid. The problem we encountered with this is that the nurses were overwhelmed because of these extra responsibilities, and so they were not able to make the 10 contacts in a timely fashion. So we had an idea to have social work make reach calls. We call them reach calls, to help ensure a contact was made in the first week of care. And we decided to have the social workers use a script, so that's included in the handout that you should have, and use a decision tree for consistent handling of the problems. And you can see on our handout what that is, too. So our process was that the social work department would receive a copy of all the identified high-risk patients and make call to the patient using the script. The script template is used for documentation of the call in the patient's record. And social work tries to make a second and third call as possible during the first 2 weeks. A log is kept regarding the calls, and calls take about 10 minutes. If the social worker discovers that there's a medical problem, then they notify the nursing supervisor, and they make a referral to social work if there's a social problem. Eva, do you want to elaborate any more?
No. We also look for problems with agency-wide systems, like any problem getting the home health aid started, or if DME is missing, or if the patient needs DME, and also any med changes that are indicated. We leave a voicemail for the case manager.
When we had started this program, we discovered some challenges, as most times you do. And one of our biggest challenges was the timeliness in, for the social work department to receive the papers. That's what happens with paper, is that it takes a while to route around to the appropriate people. And also another challenge was we had to increase social work staff. And to a four-hour shift, 5 days a week. And usually those calls are made more in the afternoon.
Right. We've utilized our per diem staff for the most part for those calls, and we do them in the late afternoon. We find that to be most effective.
And sometimes we have found also that some patients feel that that second and third call is intrusive. And so we've gotten some feedback with that, although primarily we have positive feedback from the patients that they appreciate the call from the social worker. Some positive outcomes we've seen is that our social work satisfaction rates improved, and along with the positive comments by the patients. Our agency hospitalization rate continues to decline. And nurses have some relief of the full burden for those high-risk patient interventions. We've identified that we need to make some improvements, and we're in the process of doing that. One of those things is in tracking. We've added some indicators onto our log and electronic system. We're trying to we have our electronic point-of-care system for our nurses and therapists and social workers to use in patient care, and we're trying to integrate our risk assessment form into our computer system so that we can then have it more of a report and have everybody have access to the information more timely. And we also want to work more this year on evaluating the impact of the program and especially identifying the cost versus the benefit and identifying the percentage of patients that are reaching the target of 10 contacts in the first 2 weeks of care. And then we'll also look for further ways to improve the program. That's it, unless anybody else has something to say. So that's it.
Thanks, Kathy and Eva. I'm going to ask Mike to open up the line for any questions.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from queue, please press the pound key. One moment.
While we're waiting for Mike to queue up the first question, I'm interested to know, because I know part of this, Kathy and Eva, that you're asking them about knowing who to call if they have a problem, who to call during business hours, after hours. Have you noticed that you've had a better response of patients calling you rather than just going to the emergency room or even knowing that they've gone to the emergency room? Has there been a change in that?
I think that there has. Actually, one of the other areas that we're working on is improving triage competencies and trying to get that a more formal process so that the triage nurses will be able to feel confident when the patients call as far as how they direct the patient.
Okay, great.
We also have been able to reduce the number of unmade nursing visits by knowing the disposition of our patients, if they've gone back to the hospital before we've gotten out there the first couple of days, or if they've gone to a nursing home, or if they live in assisted living. We also have been able to provide more information for nursing as to where the patient is and if there's a change in that location.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Are you noticing that you're picking up for the sort of the clinical questions about sleeping, breathing, energy level, pain? Have you been picking up opportunities to intervene sooner rather than finding out when the nurse goes maybe 2 or 3 days that they've had a problem with weight gain or sleeping or breathing?
I think one of the nice things is when they're doing the reach call, that is one of the key questions that they ask. And if there are issues, you know, social work's able to actually either, one, contact the nurse directly or leave them an updated voicemail along with an updated clinical note. So you have two avenues of communication going on there, and it seems to be working very well.
Excellent. Okay, Mike, do we have some questions?
Yes, ma'am. And our first question comes from Kathy Jablonski of Visiting Nurse Service. Your line is now open.
Hi. Good morning, everybody. Hi, Sarah. My question is, did you ever consider using non-clinical staff to make these calls? Because for myself, I can honestly tell you we have no clinical staff. Our social workers are just too busy. So was that ever a consideration?
Yes, we did consider that. We thought there would be some need to have the expertise of a clinician, you know, to be able to just guide the call. But I suppose if you were using a script and monitoring that was closely adhered to.
Right. And I'm sorry, I might have missed something in the beginning. So your nurses identify who these patients are that are at risk, and then they leave a message for who? Who do they leave a message for? For the social work department then?
No, we have a written risk assessment form.
Oh, yes, I heard, yes. Okay, and then that is given
copies
in to someone. And what else did I ask you? Okay. All right, I think that was basically it. Because I know, you know, this sounds great, but I know from my agency, we just don't have the manpower for any clinical staff I know to do that right now. So, but I work closely with my administrator. You know, I have an assistant who helps me who might be able to do it. So thank you very much.
Kathy, it's Sarah. There are some agencies that across some of the other states that, and I think a couple of ours also, that are using non-clinical.
Okay.
And that's where the scripting comes in.
Yes.
So that, you know, it's a standardized process, and the protocols such as Lifetime's got together there is really helpful.
Okay, okay. And one other question, now that you're saying that, Sarah, and maybe if there's no problems when you make the telephone call, you know, everything is fine, they know what to do, when to do it, do you feel, Sarah, that you have to do a clinical note on this then?
Yeah, I would definitely say, yeah, if you're counting this as a contact with the patient.
Right.
And just for the benefit of being able to manage those high-risk patients,
right.
I would definitely, clinician to clinician, want to know that someone's called and checked.
Okay, okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
sure.
you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
Hi, guys. This is Vicki at iPro. I have a question for you, Kathy. You're saying that the patients were feeling that the second, third call was a bit intrusive. How does the staff at the Start of Care introduce the concept of the phone contacts? And, you know, are they? And is that helping kind of smooth the path for the social worker as they're calling, trying to get this information?
We don't have the opening nurse introduce it. When the social worker calls the patient, then they're explaining what the reason for the call is.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
We do share with the patient that we have found that they're at risk for hospitalization and that our goal is to try to keep them out of the hospital. We want them to be part of the team in the effort of that.
Yeah, that's important, too, communicating that high-risk status at the Start of Care. That's a critical point, Kathy. Great job. I'm very impressed with this program.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions, Mike, for Kathy and
yes,
Mark
ma'am.
And Eva?
Our next question comes from Susan, and I apologize if I mispronounce your last name, Ambrosi of Seton Home Healthcare. Your line is now open.
Good morning. I had a question regarding the tool that you're using. Did you say that this is what you use to document in the clinical record the call that was made to the patient?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, what we're able to do is actually take an electronic copy. We cut and paste that script, so it's all basically in a Word document, and that Word document's cut and pasted into clinical notes. So they answer the questions right off the script directly into the clinical note. And we do that for each patient.
So that becomes part of your electronic medical record then?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, that's what I was wondering. Great, thanks.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Natalie Carey of Visiting Nurse Service. Your line is now open.
Yes, good morning. I was just curious because you had said that you're using per diem social workers. So how are the per diem social workers getting paid when this isn't a visit that's reimbursable?
We have a different pay system. We don't pay them by the hour. We pay a session rate. So we pay a four-hour block of time, and everyone gets the same pay for the four-hour block of time. It's a different pay system than most places have, but that's how we pay all of our staff, all of our per diem staff. We also pay per visit for per diem staff, so it's a different structure.
And you're finding that paying them this four-hour block of time, even though it's not associated with a revenue-producing visit, in the long run, because you're reducing your hospitalization rate, it's paying for itself.
Yes.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Carol Ann Thomas of St. Peter's Home Care. Your line is now open.
Okay. Good morning. This is actually Annette Tuffy. And my question is, you have the electronic system. Which system do you have? Is it Beyond Now, Delta?
We have MISIS.
MISIS. And does that MISIS come with the Word document, or do you have to purchase licensure for the Word software?
No. No, Word is just, you know, the normal Word that would be on anybody's computer, and we just have it typed out, and then we cut and paste it onto clinical notes. MISIS allows us to put text in, and that's the text.
Oh, okay. So you don't have to purchase a license for each individual laptop for Word?
For Office, Microsoft Office, yes.
For Microsoft Office, yes, we do.
Oh, okay.
We have that on the laptop, so.
Each individual laptop?
Yes.
Okay, so that gives you a lot of leeway, so you don't have a lot of duplication as far as having a lot of paper assessments. This is what the burden is for the nurses, I think, is having the paper and then the laptop, you know, and kind of streamlining that, as well
that's
as
right.
You miss the communication if it's paper in the chart, so.
Yeah, that's why we're trying really hard to get it into all electronic.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. I'm showing no further questions.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Kathy and Eva and Mark, I want to thank you so much for reviewing your tool and your protocol with us. I think it's very helpful because I know everybody's struggling with, you know, once the high-risk patients are identified, how do you increase those numbers of contacts? And the telephone monitoring piece and the scripting here I think is very helpful for agencies to use, and I appreciate you sharing that with us and sharing your expertise with us. So with that, I'm going to introduce Jeannie. Our second presenter is Jeannie Leising, and Jeannie is the Director of Performance Improvement and Staff Development for Macaulay Seton Home Care, and they are part of the Catholic Health System and based out of Cheektowaga, New York. And Jeannie's agency has also collaborated very closely with our iPro Home Health Project team since back towards 2003. And she's going to share some information on the innovative program their agency undertook with the graduates of the SUNY Buffalo Industrial Engineering School. And they focused on a unique approach to pay for performance in home care based upon review of agency systems and processes and the relationship between patient outcomes, all of which has had a very positive impact on their patient outcomes, such as acute care hospitalization and oral medication management. So with that, Jeannie, I'm going to turn the call over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Sarah. Good morning, everybody. What I'm about to embark and explain to you in regards to the pay-for-performance and home care as a unique approach working with the UB students, I just would like to point out that the information I'm about to share is not exactly earth-shattering the findings, but the fact that they come about it in such a different way than what we're used to going in the data we're used to collecting. So working with the students, they work with the mathematics and the statistics, and are able to dissect the data and give us different information into a greater depth than what we have in any other setting or where we're able to get it from. So as we're all data-driven and looking for answers and unique approaches to managing our patients and making improvements, we embarked upon this project. We work with Dr. Lee Lin out of the UB Industrial Engineering School, and he was able to identify that you could apply the principles of engineering in a healthcare setting, and that because it's process-driven, that they may have an impact here in home care. A couple of years ago, we worked with them on a scheduling process where they could come in, and we've been trying to dissect the scheduling and make it better for a long period of time. We had a couple students come in under 10 minutes. They could tell us what the process was, what it should be, and how we could make it better, which has led to other projects with this student. So this is taking a unique approach to a common healthcare issue, obtaining this data that's not elsewhere classified or specified or analyzed for us, and then looking in depth, taking that depth of detail through the statistical measurements, but we're not so much focused on the clinical, all the clinical knowledge we have, and we're very interested to see what and where the students go with this data. The students do not have healthcare backgrounds, so it makes it extra interesting to work with them to see that they can come up to the same conclusions that we would gather by being on the clinical side. So how did we approach this? And I'm going to apologize in advance. I know when you do PowerPoint, I hope everybody has the presentation. It shouldn't be so wordy, but in order to follow where I'm going to go with this, I needed to put the words on the document. So the approach is we educated the students on pay-for-performance. We looked at our OBQI efforts of our agency, and then we shared particular documentation tools with them so they could see how we gather the data in home care. So the OASIS, we also shared our outcome reports, and the fact that there's publicly reported data available, where the site was and what our report looked like. So we looked at what was on our problems. We had lower than national and New York scores for pain, transferring, and ambulation, and looking at is there a correlation between the three areas, and is there a way you could focus in to actually make better improvements in multiple areas at one time. So as you look at slide 5, this is where Macaulay Seton Home Care was. And what we did was we looked at New York State compared to national, and we took our home health care compare data. At the time we started the project, the most current data we had was kind of the tan color grid, and then it goes back. So as an agency, if you move over to pain, the third set of columns, we had focused in on pain management, and that has been an ongoing project for at least 3 years now, and we have seen significant improvements in pain. But as we've improved in pain, we've also seen improvements in the other areas, which is something that you may expect. We've moved from a 49% improvement up to 63%, but at the same time look to see how could we actually have a better impact on transferring an ambulation. The next slide is just a definition here of the transferring. I know everybody has this information. I wanted to include it. And then the ambulation. So the students took research questions, such as, does pain affect transferring an ambulation? Does the age and gender? Does the number of health professional visits? Does a primary diagnosis? Is there a relationship between transferring an ambulation? And does it matter who the patient lives with, and will that have any effect? So to get the process started, we had to collect a lot of data. And what we wanted to impress upon the students is that the data isn't always at our fingertips. We use the McKesson HBOC system. We use the analyzer product. I have OCS for outcomes. And there's multiple sources for data, but to get sometimes the depth of what you're looking for, it isn't readily available for us on top of using our own IT department. So we looked at our patient population and defined it as all 2006 Medicare discharged episodes. And we picked particular indicators that would be created into a spreadsheet. And that was tricky. I didn't want to skew where they were going with their data, so we just talked through some of the indicators, such as gender, age. We include many of the MOOC questions. Not everything is listed here. Looking at the length of stay, the number of visits, primary diagnosis codes, was the patient hospitalized, and then in particular the pain management, transferring, ambulation, and they're very intrigued as students with the MO 825 and the fact that it's so heavily weighted in an OASIS. We had to retrieve data from McKesson and from the analyzer product as well. We also had to create custom reports, and I needed to work with VantaHealth to get the reports that were required. The students then had to take all the data and all the patients and every MO question and every start of care discharge and create a coding system associated with everything, including the diagnosis. So they put it down into the simplest forms, such as a male or female is one, a male is two. Every data set had to be coded out for them to be able to do their analysis. So the statistical measures that they began to use were the paired t-test. And they felt that if you cannot tell the difference, if there is no difference between the start of care and discharge scores, then there's no sense continuing any further. And just to be clear, I am not a statistician. When they begin to talk about the statistical measurements and what they're doing, it really stretches my brain, which is a good thing, begins to have you look at things a little bit differently and from a different perspective, takes you out of the straight healthcare arena. So they detected that, yes, we did have differences so that the study should continue. They also used histograms. They were doing advanced statistics, regression, such as linear and ordinal logistic regression, and they felt that the ordinal regression was the biggest component. On slide 13, I'm not giving all the data here because I know it's a lot and we're not used to looking at it this way, but they did a paired t-test, and what that told them was, at the bottom of the slide, with the 95% confidence interval, because it doesn't include zero, there is a difference between our scores. We know that when we see the outcome scores, but they know it by looking at these statistics, just like our outcome vendors would use. The p-value was statistically significant, and there is a difference between our scores. So what does that mean? It just means that we had a difference in our scores. The project should continue. The logistic regression that was used is predicting group membership from any set of variables. So they looked at multiple variables and used that test. They also did an ordinal logistic regression, which is performing a regression with the variables such as agree, disagree, strongly disagree, or in our case, coding out OASIS questions based on the 0 to 5 response. So what they found, when they began to look at the MO 700 for the start of care scores for the ambulation, they found that if somebody scored at a level 1, the odds of them belonging to an ambulation score of 5 or being bedfast was 7%. Compared to the odds of belonging to any of the other score grouping within that question. At a 2 on the next slide, the level 5 is 38%. And as a patient moved up to a pain score of all the time, they had a 50% chance of being in the level 5 for the ambulation question. The discharge scores, then, they began to take a look at to see what were the odds of somebody belonging into a particular group. And what they found was that if you scored at a 1, it was 28%. 2, it was 57%. And 3, it was 76%. So there was high odds of somebody belonging in that group. On slide 24, it's just a comparison between the pain levels 1, 2, and 3, the ambulation scores at start of care and at discharge, and then what was the difference in the odds between the scores. So obviously if you managed pain, what it's telling you, your patients should not be in such a high score level. So they looked at those scores and indicated that pain would be the area of greatest focus, and if you focused in on pain, you could have the greatest improvement in your scores for ambulation. They did the same for the transferring scores, which is the slide 26 for the Mo 690, and it came out the same way, which is not something unusual or unexpected for us. We imagine if a patient has greater pain, they'd have greater difficulty with, that's the question, does it interfere with your activity, and we do expect that it would. On slide 28, it's the correlation looking at transferring to the visit and the kind of the teal color. As the transferring score increased, the number of PT visits increased. That's a good thing. As a person had more need, we provided more PT visits. The next slide, the correlation for ambulation, is as the ambulation score improved, the number of nursing visits decreased. As it improved, the number of aid visits decreased. Of interest, and something I've never really been able to put my finger on or look at it in this way, as the age increased, we had less nursing visits and more PT. And again, you could think aging in place. The person may need more PT visits to remain independent in their home, but this was just a slice of the data that put it right there in front of us. The females actually had more OT visits, which raised an interesting question in my mind, and do we treat males and females differently? And it doesn't, it's across the board taking out for the fact that we do have a greater female population that is taken out of it. It's kind of like that risk adjusted that actually we're giving females more OT visits in the home. Maybe it has to do with the caretaker, cooking more of a traditional female role, that I don't know. The length of stay. As the start of care transferring score increased, the length of stay increased. And as ambulation score increased, the length of stay again increased, which is what we would think. We'd put in more visits to help the person gain their independence. So they found that there was a relationship between all three questions, transferring and PT, the nursing and AIDS, and also the length of stay. When they looked at it as a pay for performance, and this, again, is only the tip of the iceberg. I think I say that a little bit later. They sliced and diced multiple OASIS questions. We have a ton of data. What I'm really just trying to show is that they can come up with different indicators, greater depth of data, using the statistical measures and taking out the straight clinical focus. And that then can help us use that data, streamlines it for us, and put that into our programs. So they recommended focusing on patients that had a pain level of 3 to decrease the transferring and ambulation scores, meaning move down the scale, to the greatest extent. That there was a difference between the start of care and discharge scores, and that through the testing, they could look at the possibility that the treatment is producing the difference, but they were somewhat limited. They also stated, these are their words on the slide, did not actually collect this data, so they're not sure what other factors could be affecting their study. They don't know much about patients' medications at this point. It wasn't one of the indicators we collected, and it might find out that medications are affecting the patient's treatment. And that the questionnaire in and of itself, meaning the OASIS, captures the patient's ability, but they wonder if the OASIS tool is reliable enough to do this. They felt that something that we know, but it's interesting to me, we've worked with the OASIS for years, and working with the students, they were able to take a look at the OASIS tool and really in under a couple of weeks come back and say, you know what, this tool is very cumbersome. It's open to individual interpretation based on understanding of all the questions on it. They felt that the tool needed simplification, and I mentioned I think we're going up about 19 questions, although it's supposed to come out somewhat neutral, I think we're going to see an increase in the questions. They questioned if the tool really captured the reality of the patient's status, and was it truly designed to enable a company to show patients improvement? And I've heard all kinds of comments along this way throughout my time in home care, Many questions have been raised about the tool, the fact that although there is standardization, people may open it up to different interpretation, and it depends on how well they understand the OASIS question and all the factors that go into it. So that was very interesting to me that they can come up by never really working with the tool and just looking at it for this project and ask those questions. They were surprised that those with scores of 5 for ambulation and transferring often had a shorter length of stay. And they thought, if a person is that debilitated, why would they be with us for a shorter period of time? It did raise a question, but it made me wonder, is the person with us for a shorter period of time because somebody who scores a 5, chances are they would have a caretaker in the home, and would we be educating the caretaker and then taking care of the medical piece of care, but not having the expectation of the person gaining greater independence? And, of course, I don't know that. You just look at the question. It makes you question yourself. For Macaulay Seton Home Care, how do we use this data? It helps us to examine our current visit pattern. Our pain management is key to our other questions. It did raise a question for me in ethics. Are we treating patients differently? And if so, why? I've never heard anybody talk about giving females more service than males, or treating in any different fashion or applying different services. Maybe they're more accepting to care. I don't know. Peers appropriate use of PT and nursing visits are taking place, and that the visit patterns and outcome is something that they're still looking to as related to a patient and their caretaker. So what this does is it gives us greater detail, a few different areas of focus other than any data we've been given so far, in at least in our setting here in home care. It allows for us to further look at our patients and approach with factual data, and then put approach into program development based on the data, and then put out the education efforts, and then the continued management and monitoring through the PI end of things. So as I said, it's only the tip of the iceberg. It's a continued work in progress, and we still don't have all the analysis from the students because you can slice this data so many different ways. But they will actually have enough data to publish the study. I'm working with graduate students, and one is doing her PhD. So my observations are that time working with graduate students are well worth the effort. By removing any of the extraneous details from a problem, you take out all the clinical focus and look at the numbers and look at the issues. The solution can become very clear to you. I also know that our current IT needs do not meet the progressive PI needs. We're forever looking for another report that's not available or something a little bit more in-depth. And then working with another industry really opens up your mind to the possibilities for healthcare change. Working with the students has really been a fantastic project. And anybody who has the opportunity or might be able to pull a link with a school or a college near your area, university, would be, I think it would be well worth the effort. We also in the past have worked with graduate students through the Health Service Administration program at a local college here, and they've done internships with us. It's always fun to see somebody else's perspective when they come into the home care setting from the outside. So I would like to thank Sarah and Christine, Vicki, for taking an interest in this different approach, and the UB students, Jeff and Priya, and Dr. Lee Lin for actually having the idea that you could link industrial engineering to the healthcare setting. And with that, I am done.
Okay, Jeannie, thanks so much. I'm going to ask Mike to queue up everyone for questions.
Certainly. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from queue, please press the pound key. One moment.
And as Mike is queuing everyone for questions, I just want to make a comment, Jeannie. It doesn't surprise me that the engineering, since that's where performance improvement started, it doesn't surprise me that they were able to come to some of the same conclusions that you thought were actually possible. What did you, if I could ask, for you had focused in or noticed that the patients in the pain 3 score group, there was an opportunity to improve the other two outcomes. Was there anything specific that you've done thus far with that information for those particular patients?
We haven't taken this information any further out because we're continuing to receive data from them. But okay. What we have done is by focusing in on the pain management, we just keep reviewing what that question is. And for whatever reason, we seem to have a great I guess, mind block, that it's about the patient's ability. Does it interfere with their activity or movement? And so many times when we still, after all this education, we still hear, well, their pain is at a level of 8, and tie it into this particular question. So we just continue to re-review on a regular basis, but we haven't had the opportunity to tie this data.
Okay. And I just was wondering, what was the response of your staff to be interacting with the engineering students?
They don't have that much interaction with them. I tend to work with them and pull in several people from the PI. I have a clinical resource management and also staff development so that they're exposed to thinking about things differently and hearing it from a different perspective.
Uh-huh.
But it's mostly been along the leadership team.
And have they been accepting of a different discipline, if you will?
Very much so. Very much so. I think because I get so excited about it, not just myself, but I do. It's a very exciting project to work with somebody else from a different perspective, and they're very interested. And as I said, it really stretches what you think or how you think about things when you hear the questions and the review and where they're coming from without any healthcare knowledge or background. It just makes you begin to look at things differently.
Absolutely, because I think we all live and breathe this, and sometimes there's things we may not that are there that we just don't see because we're so entrenched with the day-to-day work.
Correct.
Excellent.
Yeah, I have a question. Jeannie, hi, this is Vicki. All I can say is, wow, I have to tell you, this is just the most exciting project I've heard of in recent months. And one of my questions is, one, yeah, but must have a very high level of confidence that your OASIS data is accurate. How do you train your staff, and how have you tied in your OASIS education to really come out with exactly what you thought you would come out with? You have a patient who has an increased transferring need. You're seeing an increase in physical therapy visits. Those correlations are significant. And so how do you manage your OASIS education?
When a person comes in to the agency, of course, they are trained. We also have changed our orientation to be a 60-day out reorientation with another complete focus half-day session on the OASIS in and of itself, and we refer people to the site for OASIS training.
Okay.
Then internally, we focus on those questions that are our OBQI efforts as well and continue to focus in our wound management review of questions. And the expected responses. We put things in agency newsletter, take outcome data to the team meetings. And a lot of times, I don't know if others find this, but maybe I don't get there often enough, you still have data disbelief. They don't believe that the data is really telling them something, but it is. And what I find when you get a few engaged in a group, you're able then to have even side conversations with others, and they begin to see the questions and how things work. But we just keep taking it back to the team members, to the team level. We do agency education, the teleconferences.
Right.
So I don't know that. I don't think we have any magic bullet. We just keep
plugging away at it and communicating.
And break down the data into individual questions more and more by our data and by our outcomes, and then continue to refocus our agency on those areas that we have deemed to be of importance to the patient. As you know, you can only focus on so many at one time, but the areas that would have the greatest impact on the patient and should show the greatest improvement.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mike, do we have any questions from the participants?
No, ma'am. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. I'm showing no questions.
Okay, great. Jeannie, I have to thank you so much for sharing such an exciting program with us, and we'll be interested on your next steps and how you're going to approach the care piece for it. So you'll have to keep us posted.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing the information. We do have a few minutes left, so I just thought I would update everyone on sort of where we are with acute care hospitalization and where we are statewide with oral medication management. This information is on those monthly trend reports that you'll receive monthly. We'll be sending them out this week and next week to all of you. For acute care hospitalization, Our statewide rate went down very slightly. We were last month at 40.28. We are down this month to 40.14, so just a slight decrease. The top 10 New York State agencies' rates average for acute care hospitalization are 16.59. So there are some agencies that have some significantly lower acute care hospitalization rates. As far as national actually came down this month. National rate for acute care hospitalization was 28.66 last month, and it's down to 28.57, so that slightly decreased. So the national is sort of mimicking where we are also in New York State. We're still, it looks like one of the second highest states for rates for acute care hospitalization. When we look across each of the types of agencies across New York State, both downstate and upstate region, pretty much all of the agency types in both regions went up a little bit for acute care hospitalizations this last time period, with the exception of the downstate CHA agencies. They decreased, as well as the downstate combined agencies decreased their rates. And that fluctuates month to month. So that's where we are with acute care hospitalization. And I should remind you all that at the end of August, which is next week, marks the end of the remeasurement period the CMS remeasurement period. So if you remember when we started this way back in August of 2005, CMS used the July 2004 acute care hospitalization baseline rate, our average for New York State and each of the agencies' rates as baseline. So the reporting period of September 2006 to August of 2007 will be the 12-month remeasurement period report that CMS is going to take a look at to see if we've made improvements statewide and at the individual agency level. And unfortunately, we won't see that August data because of the OASIS lag time to somewhere around the end of October, beginning of November. But we are tracking month to month to see how everybody's doing. And that's the same case also for oral medication management. Same reporting period, same baseline period, and same remeasurement. And you'll recall that the improvement in management of oral medications was our statewide measure for this ACE scope of work. And what we've seen, and we've shared, I think, on the previous call with you, is that we've seen a decrease. And remember, for oral meds, we want to see an increase in the rate. We've seen a decrease in the rate over the last four-month time period. We were up as high as 38.1. Zero back in January of this year. And since January, we've seen a significant decrease in the oral medication management rate to where we're at 36.79. So our high was 38.10. We're down to 36.79. And we're not seeing that on the national level. What we see on the national level is that the rate has increased to 42.41 from 42.22. So what we're seeing in New York State is not mimicking or representative of what we're seeing on a national level. There are a lot of states nationally that are focusing in on this measure, so it's not surprising that on a national level we'll see it increase. We were very pleased to see it increase for New York and are somewhat perplexed with it decreasing so much over the last four-month time period. Although we do know a lot of agencies are focusing in on the campaign, and there are some other competing priorities that are out there for all of you. We did focus in on our conference call last month with you on the oral medication management strategies, and we're hoping that some of you are taking at least the assessment piece to look at that piece for your staff. The top 10 high-performing statewide New York State agencies for oral medication management are up to a rate of 54.73. So we do have some agencies performing well. And again, as I look at the report across all of the downstate and upstate agency types, I'm seeing a decrease across all of the settings for this particular measure this month. So we're hoping that unfortunately, the months that have already taken place, which are the current data is up to May 2007. We're hoping that the interventions and the focus that you've done for the June, July, August period will have a more positive impact on our statewide oral medication management rate. So that's how we're standing right now. I just want to remind everyone that we sent you out your immunization remeasurement surveys about 3 weeks ago, and are actually about a month and a half ago. They are due at the end of August, so if you haven't completed your immunization survey, which asks you about your immunization practices for influenza and pneumococcal immunizations in your agency, if you could look for that survey and return that to us. Our next call for the clinical strategies improvement is going to take place on Wednesday, September 12th, again from the 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Time period. And that's going to focus in on immunizations. It's the Home Health Quality Improvement Campaign topic area of the month, and we're going to talk about, again, influenza pneumococcal immunization and some strategies for assessment and educational strategies for both staff and patients for agencies. We also would ask you to complete those evaluation forms that we forwarded with today's presentation materials. We do take the information that you provide to us to heart, and we certainly appreciate your time in both joining us for the call and giving us your feedback on the particular presentations. We'd like to thank very much our presenters for today. They did an excellent job, and if you have any additional questions that you didn't feel comfortable to ask on today's call, please feel free to contact one of our iPro Home Health Project team members, and we can certainly pose the question to the presenters for today's call. Thank you again for your interest and participation. And with that, Mike, we can end today's call.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation, and have a wonderful day. You may all disconnect.